This episode of Registry Matters is brought to you by our patrons. Thank you for your continued loyalty and support.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 320 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you?
Doing awesome. Aren't you going to ask me at some point how much longer I'm going to stay?
Oh, I probably should ask you that. So, I will ask you, how much longer are you going to stay?
How much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
There you go.
All right. I'd say another couple episodes for sure.
Just at least a couple? Okay. There's a podcast I listen to that it's very, very, very tech heavy, and they are approaching episode 1,000, and they were like, there's no way we're going to make it more than 1,000 episodes. And the guy that made it, he like never had any intention on having a fourth digit. And they're like an episode or two away. And he's like, I'm going to have to do some work to figure out how to make everything work and go past 1,000 or 999 and go to the four digits. So anyway, we're not really quite there yet. You think you'll make it to 999?
I have my doubts.
Well, very well. Please head over and press like, subscribe. If you really want to, if you would be so very kind and generous to send to put out a review on your favorite app, particularly like iTunes, and there's something new there, pressing follow of some kind, then that would help people find the podcast. We've been doing this for a while, and I'm sure there are some people in the PFR community that don't know that we exist. Would you say that's probably true, Larry?
Based on our audience statistics, I'm fairly confident that's true.
And then you can head over to patreon.com, and as there are a dozen or so people listening now, you could listen to us recording this live as we are recording, and you can poke fun at me in making statements about how I pronounce words sometimes. With all that said, Larry, would you tell us what we are doing on this episode?
Well, we began with bad news. Chance is unable to be with us, so it's just Mr. Doom and Gloom for this episode.
I think everyone in the chat's probably going, oh, really? I'm so sad.
But we have some good news in the form of a letter, a very much condensed letter from Richard, which is going to be shared with our audience. And then you wanted to discuss a PFR case I've been working on here in New Mexico. Then we have a very long segment on the importance of understanding where candidates stand on criminal justice reform. And we'll be talking about president, Senate, attorney general, state legislators. And we have a few articles, but time is only going to permit us to get to one of those articles.
Very well. And hey, I'm springing this on you just at a last minute. I know that this came in quite a while ago, but I kept forgetting about it. But so it's a little bit muffled and hard to hear, but I think we have it worked out. So here's a voicemail from an individual, and let's cover this super quick.
Hello. Just wanted to ask a question. There's a person who I know in New York. He is soon to inherit some property down in South Carolina. Do not want to say the county. He wants to know, are there rules preventing him from doing so once he inherits that property? And if you have anyone from South Carolina that's on the show or has some information, he would very much love to hear.
So just in case he'd...
And FYP.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. He did. It kind of cut out for a second, and he said he's about to inherit some property in South Carolina.
And the way I understand the question, there are no rules that would prevent a person forced to register or even required to register, or even suggested that they register. There's nothing that would prevent them from the inheritance. The question would come into the utilization of the property. What is he going to use it for? Is he going to move into it himself? There could be some restrictions there, or how he's going to employ the property to try to monetize it to its maximum value, which is kind of what we do in a capitalist system. He could run into problems of what he might want to do with the property by his connection to the PFR registry, but he can certainly inherit and own the property. Now, there was a proposal some few years ago in New Mexico because of Jeffrey Epstein owning property here and not being required to register to include property ownership as one of the things that would trigger a duty to register. That would have been totally impractical. We killed it. We would kill it again if it gets put forward again, I'm confident. But that would be the thing that he would have to worry about. I'm not aware of that in South Carolina. Epstein didn't have any connections to South Carolina.
Gotcha. Did you already ask me about this, like what's happening right here that I'm highlighting?
Well, that goes into the next segment after we start the PFR situation. Yes.
I scrolled down too far. All right. Well, then I'm going to read a letter from Richard in Dropbox. And so it just, is it okay if I say who was on the dear part? I guess that's already on the screen. So yeah. Okay. So this says, Dear Mr. Miller, as I mentioned in my previous letter to you, I was awaiting the decision and order of the court in regard to my mental hygiene law, Article 10 trial. As I had predicted, I am so happy and excited to share some good news with everyone at NARSOL. I received the court's decision and order in regard to my mental hygiene law, Article 10 trial. The Honorable Daniel P. Convisor, Justice of the Supreme Court of the State of New York, County of New York, Manhattan, Borough of the City of New York, is as follows. The respondent, Richard, is the subject of a petition for PFR civil management under Article 10 of the Mental Hygiene Law. The court conducted a virtual bench trial with the consent of the parties. For the reasons outlined here, the court holds that the state did not prove by clear and convincing evidence that Richard suffers from a mental abnormality under Article 10 of the Mental Hygiene Law. This constitutes the decision and order of this court. The decision and order will be stayed until Monday, October 7th, 2024, to allow the state to seek a stay pending appeal from the First Department if the state chooses to do so. And then the last paragraph that I'll read here is, this was nothing more than an attempt by the state to continue my incarceration under false pretenses, fabrications, and exaggerations, all presented in the false narrative of public safety and protection. Fear-mongering, gossip, and innuendo were used by the state in order to present their case. Mind you, that from the moment I was served with the notice of commencement of the Mental Hygiene Law, Article 10 proceeding against me, I refused to speak to and or participate in any interview with any staff of the Office of Mental Health and Hygiene, including psychiatrists and or psychologists, on the advice of my counsel. That was the line I used in my defense, and it worked. Now, where do you want to go with that from here, there? Where are we going from there?
Well, we certainly can't read the entire letter, which was already condensed before you see what's there. But he's not very fond of the process. It worked in his case. Congratulations. We don't have that process here. I don't know how I would feel about the advice, but his attorney told him not to cooperate, and he didn't cooperate, and it worked. They didn't find the state was able to meet its burden. His theory was in the letter that had he cooperated, everything he said would have been twisted and used against him. I think he's probably right. That's what would have happened.
We've talked about that a number of times, and it's like, keep your damn mouth shut, because they will twist whatever you say into something that puts the advantage on their side.
Yes, well, congratulations. This doesn't really help the people who are agonizing in civil commitment, but those who may be facing a petition, it certainly gives you some glimmer of hope that they don't win them all. They win too many of them, but they don't win them all.
Well, very well. And let's move over to this case that you have been working on involving, it's an interesting case involving an 87-year-old man who is required to register for a pretty old conviction. It's a 20-year-old conviction dating back to 2004. The man is homeless and has significant cognitive issues because he's of your kind of age bracket there. And he has been prosecuted multiple times for failure to comply during the previous decade. Now, would you dig in and tell us about the case, please?
I'm actually doing this case pro bono. Can you imagine that? I'm working on it's because I find it so appalling. But the courts have determined that he's incompetent to stand trial, and his incompetence is probably age-related. I don't have his report, but I'm working with a couple of state representatives that he's reached out to, and we're assuming that. And if that is the case, that means it cannot be restored. He cannot be restored to competency. You cannot undo dementia. But the decision was made by all parties to consolidate those pending cases, and they dismissed them back on July 12th, 2022. Despite this fact that all agree that he's incompetent, the Bernalillo County Sheriff's Office sought a warrant for his arrest only 11 days after that determination was made in 2022. Now there's a chance. Can you admit that this is funny?
You know, I'm not even going to, if I said it was, if I thought it was, so it's not funny at all, but he's incompetent. That's not funny at all, Larry.
No, the funny is not, well, the incompetence is not funny, but what's funny is that a detective would spend his time writing up an affidavit, going down and sitting in a judge's outer office, waiting to get a judge to sign a warrant for a man he knows he cannot convict. So funny may not be the best word, but it certainly, there's something bizarre about it. Wouldn't you admit that?
I would say, I don't understand why they would sit around for a guy that's 87. Arnold Schwarzenegger at the age of 87 is probably going to be something of an imposing human being, but 87, well, most of the time, they're not very.
Well, I would say, I'll drop funny, but it's definitely bizarre that they want to lock him up so badly that they waited only 11 days, which is how many days? You have 10 days to register. They waited 11 days after that termination and filed again, despite the fact he's incompetent. The man has an opportunity to be housed again if we can get the active warrant canceled. There's no reason to have him arrested again, confined to the Metropolitan Detention Center, transported to our state hospital at Las Vegas for an evaluation. Well, we know that what the outcome will be. He is still likely incompetent to stand trial and will remain so.
Well, what should be done and what are you seeking to have done on this?
Well, the wisest course of action is to cancel the warrant and let him go back into compliance with his registration obligations.
But if he's, you know, as you put it, if he's incompetent, can he even comply?
Well, at this moment, he really has no choice but to comply. But yes, I get your point.
But then explain what you mean, what the definition of incompetence is.
Well, in this context, the definition of incompetence is whether or not he can understand the nature of the proceedings against him and cooperate with his defense attorney. It's a very low threshold. If he's oriented to person, place, and time, and generally understands the role of the judge, prosecutor, and defense attorney, he would be deemed competent to proceed. That means if he went to our state hospital, which he likely did, and they said he's incompetent, he's in pretty bad shape if he can't understand those basic things, because that's all the test for competency is. That's it in a nutshell.
Would you be able to explain how a person is deemed to be incompetent? And then what happens when a person is deemed to be incompetent?
Well, there's a couple of ways it can happen. A person is deemed incompetent by stipulation of the parties, meaning the state and the defense, or in an adversarial proceeding, meaning that it goes before a judge. In this case, the parties all agreed he's incompetent. So like I said, he was probably sent to the state hospital. They evaluated him. When a report came in, the prosecution, the defense attorney looked at it. They said, yep, he's incompetent. And we're not going to fight you on that. He's incompetent. But the next decision to be made is whether the person is dangerous. And that decision can also be by joint stipulation that the person is not dangerous, and then they are released. And that's what occurred in this case. But if the parties do not agree, there would be another adversarial hearing, and the court would determine dangerousness. They stipulated non-dangerous and incompetent.
Okay. And then has there been any progress?
Actually, there has. A state representative is working directly with him, and that representative, based on my advice, has convinced him to register. And the warrant has been canceled, and now we're looking for a more long-term permanent solution.
It would seem that he does not have to comply because they cannot put him in prison if he refuses. Then I just have to ask, kind of begs the question, why would he choose to then comply?
Well, that's a good question for two reasons. First, he has the opportunity to have permanent housing if there's no active warrant. The housing that they were working on would not accept him with the open warrant. And second, they will continue to file charges if he refuses to comply. I think you saw their track record 11 days after the joint stipulation in 2022. They filed a new case, and he's been under the radar for 2 years. They haven't been able to find him. You got to admit that that's funny. An old geezer's been able to dodge apprehension for 2 years.
He's a very shifty 87-year-old. But, you know, if he's incompetent, if he's been deemed incompetent, then they can't put him in prison.
Well, while that is true, they can and probably would seek a dangerous determination if he continues to register. The end result would be a long-term commitment at our state hospital, which would be in a locked ward. Now, I've never been in a locked hospital ward, but I'm assuming it would be somewhat softer than prison because it's supposedly a hospital setting. But anytime you're locked and you can't go and do what you want to do, he's still going to be subject to a form of confinement if he refuses to register.
And they can then, I would imagine, in my mind, Larry, you've probably never seen this movie, but I think it was the second Terminator movie, and they took Sarah Connor, and they put her in a mental institution because she thinks there's this guy from the future running around trying to kill people. But she's in a locked ward, and they got straitjackets, and they hit you with the little needle thing and knock you out and whatnot. That doesn't sound like a great situation.
I don't think it's quite that bad today. I suspect that he would be in our state hospital. He would be able to wear his own clothing. I suspect he would be treated halfway normal, like an individual. But he would have limitations on his movement, on his visitation. And despite the fact that New Mexico does not have PFR-specific civil commitment, he would be committed as a PFR to our state hospital. That is a possibility. That's exactly what I would do if I were the prosecutor. If this case kept coming up on my desk, and I know I can't order the sheriff to stop issuing warrants, I'm going to have my phone. I'm going to call the old-fashioned on the phone and tell the counselor for the defendant. I'm going to say, here's the deal. We stipulated 3 times this guy's incompetent, not dangerous. Now this is on my desk again. I'm no longer going to stipulate. I'm going to make you work for this. I'm going to argue that he is, in fact, dangerous because he refuses to register, which makes the public vulnerable to his type of behavior. I may lose, but I'm going to make you work for this. And if I can think of that, I'm fairly confident they can think of that.
Now, you being the connected policy wonk that you are, have you thought about going around and trying to figure out how you could change the law?
Yes. It's funny that you ask that because I have. And in fact, in my latest iteration of a PFR bill, I had a provision in there that did not cover dementia, but it covered physical disabilities. And I had a retired medical doctor write for me, because I'm not smart enough to write something like that, but I had a medical doctor write for me what provisions we would make for people with physical limitations. Now, I'm going to add this. I've got to reach out to the Alliance for the Mentally Ill. I've got to reach out to some other people and get some language, but we got to figure out how to accommodate people like this. But the state reps that are working with me, one is it's constituent service. The other one is just trying to help out a colleague because of the colleague's relative inexperience. But they are now very sensitive to this issue. But then when I walked them through all the nuances of trying to pass something that's pro-PFR that would make PFRs less visible to the public, I pointed out that there are minefields everywhere in this, and we've got to be very careful how we do it. But I've got new support because of this, because they can't believe that there's no provision in law. And they're saying, well, he has to go in every 90 days forever. I said, till he dies, yes. He has to go in every 90 days until he dies. And they had no idea. They're serving in the state legislature. One of them has been in quite some time. Had no idea that that's the law.
Do you think that's fairly typical that the legislative body knows pretty much nothing about, at least not, you know, like they would probably have their own pet project kind of laws, but then beyond that, they probably only know something of the scratch of the surface. Do you think that that's basically true?
It is, contrary to public belief. They know virtually nothing about most things. It goes through committees theoretically with expertise, and you trust your colleagues on the committee that if they found any defects or anything that's of concern, and they would have no idea. And see, even if it went through very seasoned veterans like me, I drafted a bill and I left out for dementia, never thought about it. It never came to my mind. If it didn't come to my mind, as aware as I am, whose mind would it come to?
Well, it's funny, Larry. Had you had dementia, you wouldn't have been able to write the bill, but you would have been aware of it.
Well, yeah, but there was no advocates there for people who have dementia. And when these things are being debated, that's the type of stand-up we need in committee. We need someone to raise their hand and say, this is Jeffrey on behalf of the Alliance for the Mentally Ill. And we work with people who have mental and cognitive issues. There's no way a person who has dementia would be able to follow all these rules. Nobody ever said that. Nobody ever thought about it.
Absolutely. 100%. And then you just, the candidate, the legislators, when it comes up for a vote, they're like, we have to protect our citizens. These people are terribly dangerous. And they just vote saying, yes, this is what the committee recommended and we'll go along with it. Unless they've had someone advising them to help them be a little bit more educated on the subject where they could present something of an educated argument.
That is correct. And that's why it's so important that PFRs get more advocates. And they'll do that by a couple of different ways. They'll do that by either becoming experts themselves and toning down their criticism and their sarcasm and calling people ugly names for being losers and having no testicles and all that kind of stuff if they will tone down their rhetoric and their hyperbole. Or they need to donate to organizations that are interested in providing advocacy, but we just don't have the bandwidth. We just don't have the resources. Most of our states don't have anybody that has that type of capacity to be in the Capitol for a long-term session for 60, 90, 120 days or whatever. You wouldn't have to be there necessarily every day, but you have to be there when something relevant is going on. And how many people can do that and have the expertise and knowledge to do it? It's just not doable.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, after a little bit of a delay and some power outage, Larry, let's move on to the main event. And you want to talk about criminal justice reform and the upcoming elections. You have this article from the Philadelphia Citizen, which is probably some liberal rag filled with propaganda. And it says, the United States incarcerates more people per capita than any of its peer nations. Our nation's state, federal, local, and tribal prisons and jails currently hold approximately 1.9 million Americans. Twice as many U.S. citizens are on probation or parole. About 75,000 of all incarcerated people are in Pennsylvania, 26% which are from Philly. Despite a 43% reduction in its jail population since 2015, PA's prisons and jails are currently incarcerating 1,600 youths. It poses the question of how can we keep reducing our incarceration rates? How do we create a system that keeps people safe and actually helps them? What are adequate and effective punishments for crimes? How can we create a justice system that helps youths? Too many Americans, including young people, the local, state, and national criminal justice system is in a dire need of reform. Now here's where the candidates stand on criminal justice. At the presidential level, although states and localities have the most control over on-the-ground legal justice systems, policing, prosecuting, sentencing, overseeing the conditions of incarceration, the president sets the national tone for criminal justice policy. Vice President Kamala Harris served as a tough-on-crime district attorney of San Francisco. overseeing the prosecution of all crimes in that city while pioneering a recidivism-reducing reentry program for young men. She was twice elected as the Attorney General of California, the state's chief law enforcement officer. In her 2020 campaign to be the Democratic nominee for president, Harris ran to the left of Biden on criminal justice reform, proposing an expanded clemency program, a new federal board to review police shootings, and the abolition of mandatory minimum sentences. She has long championed a smarter criminal justice policy where success is measured by an increase in public safety rather than an increase in conviction and incarceration. In the current election cycle, Harris has not made reform a key issue. Now, that seems good for us.
Well, it does seem that way. But is it real, as San Francisco's district attorney Harris opposed the death penalty, but as Attorney General of California, she supported it. She now opposes the federal death penalty and supports federal legalization of recreational marijuana, which we discussed on last episode. On the other hand, former President Donald Trump has promised that he will reduce violent crime through tough punishment and tougher policing. His platform includes rolling back police reform and directing federal prosecutors to seek maximum sentences. That sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it?
Yes.
This tracks with his record. In his previous term, he directed prosecutors to impose harsher punishments for lower-level and drug-related offenses. He also has been a vocal defender of the federal death penalty. But his administration also oversaw the last significant win for reformers. In December 2018, he signed the First Step Act, a groundbreaking bipartisan law that reduced mandatory minimums for some nonviolent offenders, and it would have included more but for the conservative delegation of senators led by Tom Cotton, who weakened it. But go ahead.
All right. Well, the article then states, in 1989, following a brutal attack on a female jogger in Central Park, the then real estate scion famously spent $85,000 for full-page advertisements in New York City newspapers calling for the reinstatement of the death penalty for the five black and brown youth who had, under duress, falsely confessed to the crime. Although these men have long, long been exonerated, Trump has never apologized for his role in the media melee.
Does anyone ever expect Trump to apologize for something? Now, that in and of itself is funny.
I'll actually agree that that one's funny. Now, I want to talk about where the candidates for U.S. Senate in Pennsylvania stand on criminal justice, because U.S. senators are one half of the equation to enacting all manner of federal legislation, including criminal justice reform. But this only applies at the federal level. Like the president, they also set the tone. Robert Casey Jr., a Democrat, is running for his fourth term in Pennsylvania's as Pennsylvania's senior U.S. senator. As the longest-serving Democratic senator in Pennsylvania's history, Casey has promoted criminal justice reform on both state and federal levels during his time in office. In 2020, he was one of 36 co-sponsors of the Justice in Policing Act, which aimed to establish new requirements for law enforcement officers, including implicit bias training and the use of body cameras. That same year, he introduced the Clean Slate Act to the Senate in an attempt to remove barriers to housing and employment for the formerly incarcerated. In 2021, in the wake of Walter Wallace's killing by police in West Philadelphia, Casey introduced the HELP Act, and that's H-E-L-P caps, HELP Act to divert 911 calls to social service, including mental health services. In June 2024, he introduced the Prohibiting Detention of Youth Status Offenders Act to keep children out of detention facilities. As of now, none of this legislation has become law.
And it's not going to, because of the 60-vote filibuster rule. They can't pass if they don't have the 60 votes. But his opponent is David McCormick. McCormick has never held elective office, although he has condemned the soft-on-crime agenda of elected Democrats, including his opponent. McCormick does not have stated views on criminal justice reform, and that's according to this article. He has received endorsements from the Pennsylvania State Troopers Association and the Pennsylvania Fraternal Order of Police, which was also a former Casey supporter. To me, the contrast could not be clearer. You've got a guy that has a long, long track record, and you've got a person who's got the police association endorsements. Remember, we talk about the law and order the police, the apparatus that goes. Well, if he's got the State Troopers Association and the Fraternal Order of Police, he has made commitments to them in their candidate questionnaires that made was music to their ears, and they're happy with him. To me, it's a no-brainer, unless there are more important issues to you than criminal justice reform.
Well, let's move over and look at the candidates for Pennsylvania Attorney General on criminal justice reform. Pennsylvania's Attorney General is the Commonwealth's top law enforcement official, responsible not just for prosecution and conducting criminal investigations, but also advising other statewide departments on the law, representing PA and PAN agencies in state and federal court, and generally overseeing all matters of justice. Eugene Pasquale, the Democrat who has served two terms as Auditor General of Pennsylvania from 2013 to 2021 and a member of the PA House of Representatives from 2007 to 2013, DePasquale is a long-standing figure in Pennsylvania politics. As the child of a Vietnam vet whose drug addiction led to a felony arrest and incarceration, DePasquale has said he believes strongly in second chances and understand the effects of incarceration when one can have on loved ones and communities. Although he is an attorney, he does not have prosecutorial experience. In 2020, as Auditor General, DePasquale and his office released a report saying PA taxpayers could save $100 million from the State Department of Corrections' $2.9 billion budget. The report focused on post-arrest systems with recommendations that included funding a state public defender system, limiting cash bail, better funding probation while integrating county and state probation systems, establishing treatment courts for defendants with drug addiction. In 2023, Governor Josh Shapiro adopted some of these suggested reforms as part of his Clean Slate legislation, specifically reforms centered around probation and parole.
Well, I'm going to go off script here just briefly, but this is an example of where you try to get some bipartisanship. If you've got someone who says, I can save $100 million from a $2.9 billion budget, I mean, I don't know how to do the math fast enough, but that's a significant sum of the Corrections Department budget if you could truly do that. And that ought to appeal to conservatives if they really are who they say they are. But the same report said that for every $1 spent on education in prison, that dollar would reduce taxpayers' burden by $5 in prison-related cost, a finding confirmed by 2013 research by the RAND Corporation. Is that another one of those liberal left-leaning organizations? Is RAND one of those?
I honestly don't know. I know the name, but I've never done any research into them.
But clearly there's room for more work to be done at all levels of the criminal justice system. Whatever his name, pronounce that again.
DePasquale.
Never mind.
Yeah, what I said. Go on.
We can treat people more equitably while saving taxpayers millions of dollars, something that's not only possible but also necessary. End of quote. According to his campaign website, Mr. Whatever has plans to invest in crime prevention, to pursue violent criminals, and to restore trust between citizens and law enforcement.
To contrast, the Republican candidate for Attorney General is David Sunday. York County District Attorney David Sunday is a career litigator, a former special assistant U.S. attorney who prosecuted gangs, illegal gun cases, and drug dealers, and the only candidate in the race with courtroom experience. Sunday calls himself the tough on crime candidate, pledging that he will focus on cleaning up our streets from violent and illegal drugs. The Navy veteran has received endorsements from law enforcement associations, including the Pennsylvania Sheriff's Association and the Pennsylvania Fraternal Order of Police, which represents the interests of law enforcement officers. While at the same time, Sunday has striven to place rehabilitation over retribution. His campaign website that he has seen a 30% decrease in crime and 40% reduction in prison population during his first term, in part because his office's recent implementation of parole reform, a model for statewide parole reform Governor Shapiro signed into law this year. He has pushed for treatment services for opioid users and co-founder of the York County Heroin Task Force.
Well, Mr. Sunday does sound like a more pragmatic and moderate Republican, and I love working with people who are moderate and pragmatic.
Now, I got to tell you, though, I think that the purpose of this segment is to help our audience understand that it's, quote unquote, we the people who make the choices on important offices. If we the people want change, we probably need to think about voting differently. Now, you had another angle to this segment from New Mexico. Would you dig into that a little bit?
I would have if I hadn't lost my screen. So, but where? So where are we? Oh, okay, I found it again. I do. I wanted to show the audience that it's not the lawmakers who draft these tough on crime proposals. We hear about them, and I've heard this for how many years? We've been doing this, 7 years. Well, Representative Smith drafted this. Representative Smith didn't draft anything and never has and never will. The proposals are drafted and presented to lawmakers, already drafted by advocacy groups and primarily the law enforcement apparatus, as I refer to it, when it comes to our issues. So that's where I want to go with this.
And then there is a letter that I am supposed to be showing. And as soon as, like, I will go get it. I knew it was coming, and where I don't know where it went. But begin.
I could go ahead and read the letter if you like. So.
Oh, never mind. Okay, I'm thinking that there was the thing that I got to page through. Hold on. I got this. So the one that says, Dear Senator?
Yes, that one.
Okay. Attached, please find the Bernalillo County District Attorney Office's proposed amendments and supporting documents to the Children's Code Delinquency Act for the upcoming 2025 regular legislative session. We look forward to discussing any and all matters with you when it comes to the safety of our community. Should you have any questions or concerns on how we can work together on the important issue of juvenile crime in New Mexico, please do not hesitate to contact me or... that's District Attorney, right? And we can say that name?
Yes.
Okay, that's District Attorney Bregman directly.
Okay, now that...
And thank you very much for your time.
That email was sent along with attachments of a 64-page bill, a summary of the changes that 64-page bill would effectuate. And that... you read that 64 pages, didn't you?
100% of it.
So, all right, we'll keep going.
All right.
There is a perception that juvenile crime is totally out of control and that we're too soft on offenders, and that's what's driving this. And we have a link to a story that will provide some context. There was a audio file, I hope, that we have to play.
And let me get this. You want to cover this. We're going to go over this thing with the code, right?
Well, the next thing was the audio file, the link there. Did we miss something here?
I think so. The Family Speaks Out. Is that where we are?
Yes.
Oh, well, I just figured that was a link to an article.
Yeah, you know, that's the audio that we were going to play of the what's causing the hoopla here.
All right. Well, here
if you
it
don't
comes.
Have it, okay, go ahead.
Let's get it unmuted, and I will get it started over. Are you going to cooperate with me? I think all my tech issues, like, I don't know if I have. Give me one other second. I will fix one other thing.
Good afternoon. More than 8 years after a drive-by shooting killed 17-year-old Jaden Chavez Silver, one of the men involved in that murder is getting out of prison years earlier than expected. And the mother of the victim says she's upset over how she learned it was even happening. News 13's Jessica Barón has her story.
He would walk in a room and light it up with his personality or his smile or his laugh.
Jaden Chavez Silver was weeks away from graduating from Manzano High, getting his pilot license, and joining the Air Force before everything changed on June 26, 2015.
He just liked to live life to the fullest.
Chavez Silver was with friends at a home in Northeast Albuquerque when he was killed in a drive-by shooting. 6 years later, one of the men involved, Dominic Conyers, is now set to be released from prison. Just yesterday, Nicole Chavez says she learned of the release, the DA's office saying it was supposed to take place on October 20th, Jaden's birthday.
When I said, when is the release date? And they gave me the date of October 20th, my heart dropped.
The Department of Corrections now says Conyers will be released on the 30th, but Chavez also says the DA missed their chance to tell her about Conyers' July parole hearing.
They couldn't give the common courtesy to make that call and let me know that one of Jaden's offenders was up for parole. Oh, I was so frustrated.
Although Nicole says she's grateful Conyers won't share a release date with her son's birthday, she's still upset that he's being released roughly 6 years early. She wants lawmakers to focus on crime victims.
Don't make this so political, because us as victims are left still celebrating birthdays and anniversaries and special occasions at a cemetery.
Jessica Barron, KRQE News 13.
The DA's office did not comment on why Chavez wasn't notified about Conyers' parole hearing. The Department of Corrections says it's now working to get her a meeting with the parole board.
So this is an example of media manipulation at its finest. First, the actual killer received life in prison. And the person that's referenced in the story received 10 years. And he served the entire sentence. The quote, parole, she referred to in the story, is actually not parole as you think of parole, which is considered to be an early release. He's actually being released because he served his entire sentence. But he now has a two-year mandatory period, which we call parole. It's actually a separate requirement. He was not released early, unless you consider the mandatory good time that he earned. But good time is awarded, it's in statute, and it's intended to encourage good behavior and participation in programming and rehabilitative efforts. This man served every day of his sentence, but yet you would not know it by listening to that story. He was released early, according to the media sensationalism.
Now, do you want to go through a few pages of the bill?
Sure, we can do that.
Well, as soon as you tell me where to go, I will fire that puppy up. Where do you want to go first?
Well, you read that right here.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm obviously, Larry, that I've read the bill multiple times, and it's clear they want to narrow the list of what is considered quote-unquote delinquent acts. And increase the list of offenses that will define a juvenile as a serious youthful offender. Now, do I have all of that correct?
You do. And can I go home now?
Absolutely. But no, we need to hear your predictions along with your pontifications, because that's actually why you're here, about your pontifications. Now,
not without significant changes to the language. We have a very progressive legislature, and they're not likely to roll back the clock on our juvenile justice system to this level that's being proposed. This, as it's currently drafted, is dead on arrival. One major flaw in the proposal is it would presume guilt. The proposal states serious youthful offender means an offender 15 to 18 years old who is charged with indicted for and bound over for trial. And then the list of things that they're wanting to add, you see the list. They want the first degree murder, but then they want to enhance
the list.
List
is first degree murder, then second degree,
would consider
voluntary manslaughter,
a serious
armed
offender,
robbery,
which changes
robbery
your
with the use of a firearm,
in the
shooting
juvenile justice
at
system.
Or from a motor vehicle resulting in great bodily harm or death, or shooting at a dwelling or occupied building resulting in great bodily harm or death. And
okay, now I would like to say that the story that we will put in and post was about a young man, a beautiful young guy that was about to graduate from high school as a I think he was honors or very close to it, athlete, and he was shot in a drive-by shooting, not intentionally, I don't think, but he ended up dying, Jaden Chavez Silver. And there's no amount of remorse that I can say. It's sad for a mother to lose her son in a terrible tragedy like that. But that doesn't mean that we should totally discard the whole system that we have as it currently is structured. And that's what they want to do. They want the result of one case dramatically
now,
change
now
the
while
system.
We were while you were going on that little monologue there, I researched how your election law works, and
I don't think
all 112 seats of the New Mexico legislature up for election on November 5th. And if that's the case, how can you be so certain that the liberal pointy heads will win?
Well, I can't be certain that they will win, and that's the reason why we're doing this segment about voting and the importance. If our voters do not want to roll back the clock on juvenile justice, they will need to pay very close attention to the campaign commitments that are being made and what the candidates are seeking, who are seeking election to our legislature are saying. But knowing the state as well as I do, I don't think there will be enough of a shift. I think the Republicans, the conservatives will probably pick up a couple seats in the Senate and possibly two or three, maybe four in the House. But we're still going to have Democratic control. The wild card is going to be how many seats flip and how hard the governor pushes, because the governor is not ready to hang up her political ambitions at all. And therefore, the state is perceived to be a haven for criminals. And she's trying to represent a force of moderation, and she's asking for some changes. And we had a special session in July, which the legislature just thumbed their nose at her. They convened pursuant to her legislative call. They voted on disaster relief for a local disaster, and they adjourned without considering any of her proposals. If she was able to pick up some more lawmakers or more in alignment with her, she may be able to force some of these issues that they thumb their nose at her about. If you don't want to roll back the clock, pay attention to who you're voting for. Don't buy this rhetoric about crime is on such a runaway trajectory that we're not safe here. I've been here 41 years. We've had higher crime than we have now. It is higher now than it was.
Is there anything else that you want to go over with tonight? You want to
still more than
it
was at a payday in the 90s and the 80s. Nowhere near the all-time highs.
Filtermag.org? Never heard of it.
Yes, we have an article that I want to go into great detail about.
Well, that sounds like a good title.
Where is it from, anyway, that article that I have in? It's called Enough with the PFR Registry. And there's a picture that people who are required to register are quite familiar with. There's five people on a stairwell, one banging at the door. And they look like that they're a Gestapo unit. I can't tell if anybody has their weapons drawn. It looks like that guy toward the rear might have a weapon.
Yeah,
I'd
say he's got a
thumbs on a pistol. Is he holding his weapon or his radio? The final guy in the back, not the large one. It looks like he's holding something in his right hand.
Of course.
Yeah, so this is what you deal with for a civil regulatory scheme. Now, there's five people. Five.
You seem surprised
by
this.
Not one plain clothes one. Five people, all with guns, getting all worked up about a civil regulatory scheme. And this comes from the state of Georgia. Oh, no, I'm not surprised. But what does surprise me is that people vote claiming that they're fiscally conservative and that they're trying to keep a close, tight watch on expenditures. And then they tolerate this from their local law enforcement. They tolerate this. I would be on the phone saying, Sheriff, you're crying the blues on KKOB radio all the time about not having enough deputies.
Totally.
How is it that you can send out five people to knock on a door for a civil regulatory scheme? It sounds like to me you might be overstaffed. But nobody does that. They don't connect those dots. When they hear these things, they sound good to them, and they vote based on what they hear, and they don't vote based on what's being done. Five people on this one set of stairs.
I told you something before
this
was funny.
Door. Isn't that funny?
Not really funny. Anywho, is there anything else? Can we get out of here? Very good. Make sure that you head over to registrymatters.co for show notes. and you can leave voicemail like the individual did with the inheritance at 747-227-4477. Email me and I will send it to Larry, and you can do that at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And please, if you would be so very kind, even a buck a month is very helpful. Patreon.com/registrymatters. I don't have anything else, man. I got to put all this program together because of all the drops and blips and pops and whatever else the hell happened. I suppose so. PA Dad says, it sounds to me like we are overstaffed.
That's what you're getting paid the big bucks to do. It
sounds to me like you might be overstaffed, which I assume he means you, Larry. You're overstaffed. All right. Hopefully. I hope you have a fantastic weekend, my friend, and I will talk to you very soon. Have a great night.
So, all right. And hopefully Chance will be back with us next week. Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.